From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, perspective on the rule of Saudi King Abdullah. Why did the Arab Spring turn into a cold winter?
It was naive on the part of everybody to think that uprisings of this sort would have a lasting effect.
Ebola vaccine and treatment trials are to start in West Africa. And UNICEF warns millions of children are not learning the very basics. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah has died and his brother, Crown Prince Salman, has become king. King Abdullah, thought to have been born in 1923, had ruled Saudi Arabia as king since 2006, but had run the country as de facto regent for a decade. Before that, after his predecessor, King Fahad, suffered a debilitating stroke. In 2008, King Abdullah addressed the United Nations General Assembly on the culture of peace.
فمشاكل العالم كله لا تعني سوى تنكر البشر لمبدأ العدالة.
He said the problems of the world are caused by people rejecting the principles of justice. Terrorism and crime are the enemies of God in every religion and civilization. King Salman, thought to be 79 years old, has been crown prince and defense minister since 2012. He was governor of Riyadh province for 5 decades before that. For some perspective on the death of King Abdullah and what it means for the future, VOA's Steve Norman spoke with Middle East expert Michael Fishbach, a professor of history at Randolph-Macon College and a renowned author.
The late King Abdullah was certainly one of the most significant Saudi kings in Saudi Arabia's history, going back to 1932 when it was founded. He, like all previous kings, was a son of the founder of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz. But he's always been a man from the beginning, really his first public post in Saudi in the early 1960s, as someone who's been very close to the top than he was at the top. He became the regent to his brother starting in 1996, King Fahd. So King Khaled, he's always been right near the top. And then finally actually became the king himself in 2005. That corresponded both his regency and his reign with very significant changes in the Middle East, the invasion of Iraq, relations with the United States that went through various phases, the rise of jihadist insurgencies around the world, Iran and its nuclear program, just the collapse, really, of civil society in Syria and Iraq. His reign has really corresponded with tremendous things going on in the region and in terms of relations with the United States, and he's been a very, very key person as far as American foreign policy in the region.
What about the relationship with the United States? You said it's been up and down. How would it be categorized now? Is it down? I've heard some people say that it hasn't been the best under the Obama administration. Just your thoughts on that.
Well, I think relations are not in a bad place, but some of the problems started during the Bush administration, particularly not so much the invasion of Iraq, although that did take place against an atmosphere of continued American presence in the region, which was relatively new. That only was military presence starting with the Gulf War that started in 1990-91. But in particular, the bad relations between the king, especially when he was regent and later on as king, and the Bush administration, I wouldn't call them bad relations, but he came over once famously and met President Bush in Crawford, Texas, fairly quickly on short notice, and essentially laid down the Riot Act, as we say in the United States, that the U.S. was going to do something significant about the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians, or the Saudis were going to do something drastic. Also, the Saudis famously, about a year ago, 2 years ago, refused to take a seat on the UN Security Council, and part of that was also in protest against ongoing Israeli policy with the Palestinians. The Saudis have always known their close allies with the United States and yet have been increasingly frustrated over the slow pace of that particular issue, resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As far as the Obama administration, Saudi Arabia has really been out in front of, alongside, ironically, the Israelis, in raising the threat, what they perceive as a threat of Iran, Iranian-backed organizations in the Middle East like Hezbollah, Iranian influence in Iraq, Iran's nuclear program. And I think, ironically, again, like the Israelis, there's been some frustration among the Saudi leadership about the perceived moderation toward Iran exhibited by the Obama administration. So those are a few of the highlights, I think.
What about the future now with his brother in power, I guess half-brother it is, Crown Prince Salman has already been named king. Will it be business as usual?
Well, I think like so many other relationships between, in this case, the Saudis and the world, the Saudis and the United States, that there are long-lasting strategic imperatives that continue from one leader to the other. And things such as global oil prices, stability in the Middle East, issues relating to finance, to banking around the world, these kind of issues will continue to be important even under the new king and the new crown prince. They all, you know, those kind of strategic directions change very little. What will be interesting to note is that Abdullah was known as something of a reformist inside Saudi Arabia. So I think the real test will be looking at what happens there. Abdullah was noted for changing attitudes about what we might loosely call democratic practices, about voting rights for women, and yet at the same time, a constant confrontation with Islamist movements that were more conservative and saw themselves as more correct and the government, going back to, you know, Juhayman in the late 1970s, to bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, and others like him since. There are some very deeply disaffected Saudis, and some of them have resorted to political violence. So the social questions within Saudi Arabia, some of these religious and political questions, I think is going to be a real testing ground to see where the new king is likely to go.
Michael Fishbach, a professor at Randolph-Macon College. 4 years ago, what came to be known as the Arab Spring gave hope that the Middle East might witness a long-awaited transition to democracy. The result, however, has been quite different. Observers of Middle East politics say there has been very little change in the stagnant politics of most Arab countries. The extremist group, calling itself the Islamic State, has redrawn the borders in Syria and Iraq. We see unprecedented instability in Yemen and Libya. And Egypt seems to have returned to autocracy. Only Tunisia, some say, has witnessed a real degree of success in moving toward democracy. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy discussed the shortcomings of the Arab Spring with scholar Maria Atway of the Wilson Center in Washington.
Marina Atway, what was termed as Arab Spring turned into some sort of cold winter. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think transformations of a society are always extremely difficult. And I think it was naive on the part of everybody to think that uprisings of this sort would have a lasting effect. The important thing is what happened next. And in the case of Tunisia, for example, where you had organized political parties, organized political forces on both sides, both in terms of change and maintaining the status quo, that intervene in the process, you ended up by having not a revolution, but certainly a transition towards a normal political process of participation and so on. In a country like Egypt, where the political forces were very disorganized. The youth movements, for example, never went beyond the capacity to mobilize people to come out on the street. You cannot run a country through mobilizing people to come out in the street. So that essentially, that what was missing in Egypt was an organized political force that could intervene other than the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood frightened the military into taking over again.
So where do you see Egypt headed 4 years after its uprising of 2011?
I think for the foreseeable future, we are going to stay with this very repressive political system. Whether or not they can get the economy in order to some extent, I don't know. But certainly there is not going to be any movement politically right now. Is there going to be another push from the bottom, another uprising of sorts at some point? It's possible, but I don't see it happening immediately. I think right now it's repression.
How could both Egypt and Yemen get over the challenge of going backward toward autocracy?
Well, I think Yemen is very different from Egypt because Egypt, the state is still intact. There is still, it's a very authoritarian state, but the state is still intact. The administration is still intact and so on. So that in a sense, it is conceivable to think that it will open up, that there will be, for example, if the government decided to leave more space for the political party to run into the elections and so on, it could change towards a more open, not democratic, but at least somewhat more open political system. I think in Yemen at this point, I mean, Yemen was always a very tribal country, but it has almost disintegrated into militias and tribal groups and so on, so that you cannot even start talking about a new political system at this point. The big challenge is whether that state can be put together one way or another.
Final question. What could the U.S. do to impact a real transition to democracy, especially in Egypt?
I think the United States, unfortunately, has very little leverage on al-Sisi. He does not owe his power to any support he gets from the United States. And he knows very well that the United States does not want to lose that relations with Egypt because of its interest in not only Israel, frankly, but more broadly in the entire region. Egypt is, after all, a stable country, and it's a country that has a military, for example, which could become crucial in restabilizing Libya, for example.
Marina Attaway of the Wilson Center in Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
President Obama embarks on a 3-day visit to India beginning Sunday, his second official visit to the country in what the White House calls the latest sign that increasing U.S. engagement with New Delhi is a top foreign policy priority. Mr. Obama will become the first U.S. president to be the chief guest at India's Republic Day ceremonies Monday, when the Indian Constitution went into effect in 1950. Climate change, boosting trade and investment, security cooperation, Afghanistan and Iran are expected to be among the issues to be discussed between Mr. Obama and Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who visited Washington in September. Both leaders will speak to U.S. and Indian businessmen about broadening the trade relationship currently running at about $100 billion annually. Mr. Obama will also address the Indian people Tuesday and even take part in Mr. Modi's monthly radio phone-in program. He and First Lady Michelle Obama will also visit the Taj Mahal. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes describes the relationship between the two leaders as good chemistry. National University of Singapore Indian analyst Kanti Prasad Bajpayee tells VOA's Victor Beatty he believes he knows why.
I mean, I think Obama works well with Indian leaders. He often displayed his affection for Manmohan Singh as well. But I think what he likes in Modi is the fact that he's decisive, that he has a good majority in parliament, so he can be effective. And I think he likes his verbal quickness and the fact that he's a performer in public, which I think Obama is as well. So there's respect for him as a leader and a kind of rapport as a performer in public.
Prime Minister Modi has extended to President Obama the singular title of chief guest of the Republic Day festivities in India on Monday.
In India, do honor foreign guests by inviting them to preside over the Republic Day parade. Of course, no U.S. president has been given that honor or has been able to come. So I think it really is a measure of how much Modi wants to reach out to the United States and wants to send a geopolitical message as well.
What are the driving issues in this relationship?
China looms very large for both countries, and of course, China is India's immediate neighbor. So I think that's the clear first-order geopolitical issue. A second, of course, is the rise of militant Islam and I think the rise of IS and the U.S.'s move away from Afghanistan gradually in terms of its military presence. That means that, you know, the Indians are quite worried as well about militant Islam coming very close to their borders. So I think that's another common interest that the two countries have. Beyond that, issues such as energy security in the light of climate change, I think, are going to be very big. India and the United States are looking for a climate change deal. They're far apart on a global deal at the moment, but the recent agreement between the United States and China has resonated in India, and I think New Delhi will be looking for a pretty ambitious deal there. And then, of course, I think on the American side, there's a very clear interest in opening up India's economy further so that American investors and businesses can do business in India much more easily. So I think these are some of the key drivers of the relationship at this point.
Reuters news agency is reporting that when Sri Lanka unexpectedly turned out President Rajapaksa in an election early this month, it was seen as a big setback in decades for China's expansion into South Asia, and that India may have played a hand in that in this new policy called Act East. What can you tell us about that?
There is stuff floating around in the media on India's role in the last elections, but I would be careful. I mean, that's a pretty serious accusation almost, and India traditionally has been fairly careful about its interventions. Of course, where you're right is that China's docking of submarines, its investments in port building in Sri Lanka, its growing investments and trade relationship. I think Modi has certainly made a bit of a change here. I think the previous government was far more understanding about the smaller countries' outreach to China, their need for investment and trade. But I think Modi has decided to act more proactively to build India's relationship with the smaller countries. And so he's made it, I think, fairly clear that he would like to see the new president come to visit India. And that's been reciprocated in Sri Lanka. So I think the Americans will be watching to see just how much India is now going to move out into the region, both South Asia and Southeast Asia, to assert itself against the Chinese presence in the years to come.
Bajpayee says the two countries are already engaged in intelligence sharing in a joint effort to combat terrorism. He also says India has begun to open its market wider to foreign investment in the insurance and defense industries, but acknowledges more needs to be done, especially in longer-term investment. U.S. officials say new Ebola vaccine and treatment trials are about to begin in West Africa. VOA's Steve Barragona has details.
In about 2 weeks, health workers, burial teams, and others at high risk of infection will begin enrolling in a vaccine study in Liberia. The clinical trial will test whether either of two vaccines prevents infection better than a placebo. In approximately 3 weeks, doctors in Liberia also will begin testing the experimental drug ZMapp on infected patients. Anthony Fauci heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He noted that several patients received the treatment last year.
However, because the drug was not administered in the context of a clinical trial, it is not possible to determine whether ZMapp actually benefited those patients in whom it was used.
Results from both the vaccine and ZMapp trials are expected 9 months to a year from now. The declining number of Ebola cases in West Africa is good news, but experts say testing drugs and vaccines now becomes harder. Fauci, however, says the tests may still prove useful in the current outbreak,
particularly in the event of a rebound, as well as in future outbreaks, which historically we know have shown to be inevitable.
Also, if the vaccines prove to safely boost a recipient's immune system, that may be enough for U.S. regulators to approve them quickly under rules for special circumstances. The latest World Health Organization figures show the Ebola epidemic has infected more than 21,000 people and that more than 8,600 individuals have died. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Children's Fund says global education is in crisis. In a new report, UNICEF warns millions of children are not learning the very basics. The report was released at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
UNICEF Deputy Executive Director Yoka Brandt describes education as a human right, saying there's a moral obligation to invest in it.
Education can put people on a path towards good health, empowerment and employment, and it helps to rebuild more peaceful societies. It gives children in emergencies a future, a place of safety and a sense of normalcy. And we all know that the benefits of girls' education go well beyond their own education, but extend to their children.
Brand says despite the benefits education offers, there is an education crisis.
58 million children and 63 million adolescents are out of school. And worse, we're also facing a learning crisis because an estimated 130 million children cannot read or write despite reaching grade four. And it's these two twin crises that are being addressed in this new UNICEF report, the Investment Case for Education and Equity, which we are very pleased to launch here.
She says initial progress in enrolling children in school has slowed down, and it may be hard to reverse the trend.
The population of school-aged children, especially in the poorest countries, is increasing, and it is increasing very, very fast. For instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, over 440 million children must be enrolled by 2030 to achieve basic education for all, which means that is 2.5 times the number that are being enrolled today.
The UNICEF official says low-income countries need an additional $26 billion annually to provide basic education. She says that's the equivalent of 5% of the annual profits of the world's 15 highest-earning companies. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown took part in the report's release. He's chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Strategic Infrastructure Initiative.
It was said once that the only international language that the world understands is the cry of a child. But it seems to me that over the last year, in crisis after crisis, we have neglected children, even in the most difficult, precarious, and sad situations.
For example, he says, there are 500,000 Syrian children refugees in Lebanon, but only 100,000 have been absorbed into Lebanon's education system. Brown says the rest are vulnerable to child labor and child marriage.
We have the schools, we have the teachers, we have the agreement of the government, we have the plan. UNICEF has drawn it up, but we have not been able to find the extra $136 million in international funding that is needed.
Brown says the response to a humanitarian crisis should include an emergency fund for education.
Half the children out of school in the world are in crisis countries where there are conflicts. And the last year has been a year where we celebrated the 25th anniversary of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, but it is a year that has been more marked by the violation of the rights of millions of children.
Musician Angelique Kidjo says in many African countries, educating girls is not considered important or necessary.
In order to transform my continent, we need highly educated girls. Secondary and tertiary education are key to transform completely our society.
Kidjo is a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador.
I'm not doing this to be famous. It's not my point. It's not my purpose in life. It's because I believe deeply in the people of my continent. You give them the chance and you empower them. You don't pity them. You don't dehumanize them. You just sit with them and say, what do you need?
She told the World Economic Forum there can be no peace in the world without educating children.
Let's invest in education to live in the world of peace and take the fuel out of the terrorist group, all those angry people out there, because they felt left out of the system that we have today.
Kidjo says education gives children hope, perspective, challenges, and opportunities. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also listen to past programs. Just go up to the top of the page under the Programs tab, and I hope you'll scroll on down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.